Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau. So on Saturday, I did my first How to Host a Mystery. No, sorry, I did not do that. I did a How to Host a Murder.
Oh, okay.
And I guess I actually didn't host it. I participated in it.
Okay. So how to participate in a murder.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah.
And actually, it wasn't a game. It was just...
Did you do the blue burrito thing?
No idea what that is.
The blue burrito, because tarps are usually blue. You roll up a body.
Oh, I see.
Ah.
All right.
No?
No.
Nope, sorry.
It was called, I believe, It's the Pits. And it was set end of the 19th century. And I played an archaeologist.
With a huge mustache.
With a huge mustache and a kind of like a Panama Jack outfit. Hmm.
Going for the Indiana Jones look.
A little bit, you know. 19th century Indiana Jones look.
Did you actually dress up for this?
Yes, I did.
I call LARP.
No, he grew a giant mustache for it.
And then shaved it off, yeah. I'm curious how the mechanics of that works. I've always been interested in playing one of those.
Yeah, ditto.
Haven't had the chance.
Each character gets a booklet, and the first two pages kind of just going over kind of what the concept is. And then when round one starts, you turn the page over, and it's like one side is the information that you're supposed to keep secret, and the other side is the information you're supposed to get out in that round.
Okay.
And you're not supposed to lie. So if somebody actually calls you on something, then... you can try to deflect it, but you can't actually lie and say, like, no, I did not do that.
And that's like a general rule across the board for playing the game.
I guess so. It was our general rule.
Okay.
So I believe that's the general rule.
I mean, I could see that, you know, if that rule's not in place and the game could really break down, you know, is so.
Yeah, it could just be, no, I didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Yeah.
And then at the end, you're like, well, no one's the murderer. Great game, guys. Thanks.
Well, nobody knows who the murderer is. You choose who you think the murderer is, but then on the last page of the booklet tells you who the murderer is.
Oh, okay.
Oh. So, like, you have to change booklets every time you play?
Because I think each booklet is a set character.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So you shuffle the booklets around? No, that still doesn't make sense. Like, so the booklet that you have gives the answer at the end, but then you could only use the booklet once, right?
It's play me once, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because I can't imagine how you play it again.
Yeah.
At the back of your booklet, it indicates, like, what order you should read it in.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who's, there's eight players, and the person who's number eight is the murderer.
Oh, right.
Because you read number one, and it says what their motive is, but they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, number three, and then up eight, and it's like, this person's the killer.
Yeah. And then when they finish seven, you're like, gee, I wonder who it's going to be.
Oh. It's all about the interaction in between the four rounds and the accusations. Yeah.
That's cool.
So as fast and furious as playing Battlestar Galactica with the accusations?
Yeah, I suppose. The funny thing in these games is that some information comes up in the later rounds that you're not aware of about your own character. So then you're quite surprised.
Okay.
You know, so like two of the players were married and they didn't know that at the beginning. And then I was able to use that to my advantage because somebody said he recognized me using a different name and trying to, oh, is that your identical twin? And I was like, well, if you recognize me, why didn't you say that an hour ago? You know, you're only saying this now because I accused you of doing something.
That sounds like a blast, man.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Mm. Yeah, I had a good time.
I'm sorry I missed that.
Yeah, that was hosted by one of the guys on who's in Jig.
Mm-hmm.
Kansai Jig.
Yeah. It looked like fun.
Yeah. That was my news.
Yeah, sorry, my life is boring. I got nothing.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. But more gaming news. After recording the last podcast, Wizards of the Coast put out two new classes for D&D Next.
Hey, how about us predicting the keynote speech and their approach?
Yeah, hey.
Oh, yeah.
I was pretty pleased with that.
A little attaboy, yeah.
And for those who didn't listen to last episode, we predicted that they would focus more, or not predicted, I suppose, but recommended that they should focus more on adventures and campaign settings as opposed to rulebook after rulebook.
Yeah.
Lo and behold.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. Two new classes, Sorcerer and Warlock. I don't know. Honestly, they don't look all that interesting, personally.
I think when people are complaining about the Fighter, you really just need to crank out more magic user classes. I don't know. What is there, like four magic user classes?
Yeah.
And there's one Fighter
and
one Rogue? all right. I think we got this covered. Like, what are those guys going to do in the party?
Just well, nobody's complaining about the magic users. Let's just make more of those.
Yeah. No, I wondered before, like, are there just too many, quote-unquote, like, iconic things? Or are there too many kind of, like, sacred cows that they have to put in? And, you know, they're not really able to change all that much. And
Sorcerer didn't hit the core book until the third edition.
And for that matter, the Warlock, there was a Prestige Warlock, but that wasn't the main class until 4th edition, right?
Yeah, it wasn't in the core books until 4th, yeah.
Mm.
So, like, how are these sacred cows?
I don't know. I mean, it could just be Wizard says, oh, we can't not have these in there because too many people will be angry, you know?
But what about the Ranger? What about the Paladin?
They're coming. Yeah. They're coming. They're coming.
You'd think you put one before the other.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No, I saw a good
barbarian. Hello.
Yeah, all right. I saw a good quote. I saw a good quote on Twitter that said, "If you have to have the discussion of whether something is iconic or not, it probably isn't."
Yeah.
You know, asking the question is something iconic probably kind of means no.
Yeah.
So.
But then again, warlock and sorcerer both apply to that.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying that they should be in there. Personally, I think you could get away with just, you know, the four primary classes, or even three. You know, but. Are they going to do that? Probably not.
Well, obviously, since they've made five.
Yeah.
Six.
Look at those predictions.
No, rogues don't count. I will never admit rogues.
So I was listening to both the keynote and one of the other like panels that they did on D&D Next. And, you know, audio only through the internet. And they had some...
You were listening to something, and then you go audio only. Like,
yeah, as
opposed to like
you're listening on a phone.
All right. I kind of meant as opposed to the streaming video. All right. Well, I hooked up my phonograph when my cylinder came.
There's this can on a string, and some guy was talking.
All right. Well, anyway, the point is, during one of these panels, it really seemed like they were just throwing 4E under the bus. Like, I mean, I know that when a new product comes out, you have to generate excitement for that product. And I guess sometimes that comes by saying that the previous product was inferior, whatever. But I didn't like 4E, but I don't really think the fans that do like 4E kind of deserve the backhanded treatment that they're getting. Like, one of the quotes was, "The danger of following a notion of balance too dogmatically is that balance very quickly, if you're not careful, morphs not into balance but into symmetry, which is not actually the same thing. That kind of balance at its worst makes everything identical. You'll see this sometimes in games where, well, the name of my wizard is different, or the name of what the fighter is doing, but if I look at the effects that they're doing, it's the same thing."
Which describes 4E.
Yeah, exactly.
In my opinion. I'm not a hater, but these are the... Who said this? This is Mike Merrill?
The panel was between Jeremy Crawford, the chief editor, Rodney Thompson, the lead final designer of D&D Next, and Mike Merrill, senior R&D.
Yeah, but Mike Merrill definitely was involved in 4E.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't see what you mean by throwing 4E players under the bus. I mean, I see this as they identified a problem with the system that they created, and they're owning up to it.
Are they owning up to it?
You're right. They're not saying my bad, but...
Because I'm all for a mea culpa, but it almost just sounds like they're kind of dismissing it.
Yeah. Well, it's not quite a iachare subus throwing under the bus, but I don't know.
And if they're saying, you know, balance is bad and balance eventually turns into symmetry and you don't want everything to be the same, and meanwhile, if I was sitting there, I would have sat there and said, you're talking about 4E. And I'm talking about how symmetry is bad and D&D Next is going to move away from the symmetry. Yeah. What can the people who like 4E, what other conclusion is there other than you're bagging on the game I like?
Yeah, I mean, that was a big thing. The couple of things that they promoted
when
4E came out, one was the sweet spot, which, you know, heroic, paragon, and epic. You know, there's not going to be, like, bad levels to play.
Mm.
And then the other was balance, where everybody would be balanced. And maybe it's just the wording because, you know, the lack of pronouns. But if they had said, like, you know, this is what we tried to do. You know, we went for the Holy Grail of balance. And that's really tough because balance, you know, if you try, you know, you try to go for balance too slavishly or too dogmatically, it leads to symmetry.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what we found when we tried to do that. You know, like a little bit more we in there and saying it's like, hey, we wanted this. You know why we wanted this. It was an admirable goal, and we really tried, and we realized, like, certain things break down when you try to do that. And so when it comes to D&D next, of course, we're going to try to have some sort of semblance of balance, but not at the expense of having each character class feel different and play different, so everybody has a different experience, but everybody can have fun and no one's getting outclassed. You know, I mean,
was that an audition, Lyle? Because that was fantastic.
I don't know. Like, Wayne and I were talking about it again, and it's like a real case of like fear. I don't know. Mm. And definitely sympathize with them. Like, maybe Hasbro doesn't know. Hey, who was all crazy about balance? I don't know. I think he left.
Yeah.
I think you fired him. Good.
These are one of those Christmas firings that we do every year.
Good.
Your Christmas bonus is a new job.
And one of the other ones, like, kind of talking about, like, culpability, you know, and who worked on what. One of the quotes Mike Merles said was, I use the joke. So you're playing a Shardmine Dampier hybrid Rune Priest Seeker. Like, what is that? I have no idea. When they were talking about, like, character classes and the idea that anything that was printed for 4th edition was essentially canon and legal, and you could sort of show up with that. And, I don't know, I kind of thought, hey, who worked on D&D 4E?
Yeah.
You!
Did we ask for 3-player handbooks?
No! I didn't see anyone saying, yeah, you know what, I really want a Crystal Man.
Yeah.
Who makes no sense, but I can use. And the
I know one guy wanted one.
Wow, no, but did he want one, or did he just see it and say, I want to play that?
Yeah.
But it was a question from the audience in this panel, and I thought it was really telling that, as Mike Merle says that, the guy says, yeah, but it was legal, you know, kind of as a little, like, aside, because he was a dungeon master and saying, we're behind the curve, because players are showing up with all these cards, and we don't know what half of them do because there's just too many of them. And as a dungeon master, we have to have them hand us the card, and we have to have them tell us what their character does. And we just kind of have to either memorize all that stuff or accept them kind of on blind trust and just say, yeah, okay, that's what happens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was asking, is that, you know, kind of going to D&D next? And I thought it was just, like, really telling. And I am kind of thankful that at least they mentioned there will be stuff that is not core. You know, there's going to be some that's core that'll be easier to remember, and they're going to, quote-unquote, give Dungeon Masters the ability to say, no, these are the races and things that are available in my game, which is weird, because wasn't that always the case?
Yeah, that is kind of weird.
You know?
I think we kind of play in different groups from a lot of people.
I think we must, because I heard that and I said, well, of course! I say no all the time!
Yeah, they might be referring to the RPGA, where there's kind of the official set of rules that that people who do that have to abide by.
But they always kind of do that. I think for, like, the RPGA, each season was kind of, here are the books you can build your characters from. Mm-hmm. And I don't know which ones they were, but I'm pretty sure it was not always all of them.
You know? I don't know. I reckon would they cut out the first player's handbook out of one?
I have no idea.
I think when they have, like, 3 player's handbooks, then that there was already a lot in those. There's a lot of races. I think tying what they're probably going to do, or sounds like they're going to do, and we talked about last episode, specific races, or sorry, sub-races, and maybe completely different races, mm-hmm. and classes and that too, campaign settings, is going to allow a lot of freedom. It's going to allow a lot of clarity mm-hmm. for the players and the Dungeon Master, and it's also going to allow them to branch out and do a lot of different things. It's going to allow them to experiment more. You know, they could come up with, like, some classes for this campaign setting, and everything dies, and they're like, cool, everything's all dead. It's all gone.
Yeah. Oh.
But I want to play that. And they're like, well, go ahead.
Sorry, we're not on that planet.
Go ahead, but we're not supporting it anymore. Yeah.
Well, speaking of kind of like picking and choosing and campaign setting, somebody in the panel specifically asked about deities for, you know, what was going to be in the core. And Mike Merle again indicated that he said what he wants to do, it's not set in stone, but he would really like to pick, like, the top 4 or 5 gods from, like, the 3 most popular kind of campaign settings, and those would be the deities presented in the sort of standard core world.
So there's, like, 4 gods of death?
Well,
because they're cool.
I don't know, maybe.
Wow, you know, there's only gods of death, war, and...
You know, sun, because Palor is up there.
How many suns does this world have? 1?
How much death do they have? A lot. But, again, I don't know. I kind of, the more I look at that, the more I wonder, okay, you're doing a generic fantasy world. does that really give you flavor?
Does it? Did this guy ever write a setting? Sorry, I don't mind the bag.
I have no idea.
Bag this guy, because he's obviously a very, very talented designer. Like, some of his adventures, very good. We played one of them, actually. We played one of his third edition adventures that was in Dungeon Magazine.
Oh, okay. Hmm. Oh, the boat.
Yeah, on the boat. Yeah, it was a very well-designed adventure, but has he ever designed
it? You made it better, though, by separating those ghouls.
Oh, yeah, but making it like Alien.
Yeah.
And Jaws.
That was all. That was all you. That wasn't him.
No, stop.
No, really, don't. Don't. Tell me more.
I'm going to step away from the mic. But actually, no seg at all here.
I thought you had some funny joke. But
Did I? No. Oh, those mercenaries at Wizards of the Coast. Speaking of mercenaries, we're going to be doing our next in our Warriors.
I seriously almost did a spit take.
This installment of Warriors was actually recommended by a gentleman named Jimbo Hawkins. And he wanted us to do something on the Condottieri, which I guess we'll label the episode that, even though mercenaries probably would be clear to most people.
Yeah. It's also easier to say.
Yeah. But hey, we go with what the recommendation was, which we were really excited about. Mm. So we're really pleased to do this. So that's what we're going to talk about today is the Condottieri, or mercenaries. And as with all Warriors episodes, we've just chosen a few elements that we think were pretty good and that can be applied to any character. And we've also made them Italian.
For ease of pronunciation.
All right. But a little background. The Condottieri are basically those mercenary bands around about the 13th, 14th century. They started to appear. But they went on a little bit afterwards. And they kind of came about because of the rise of some states like Genoa, where they were very rich from trading, but they didn't have a standing army. Mm. So they would hire these bands of mercenaries. And also, mercenaries became very prevalent during the Hundred Years' War, and there were like companies such as the very famous Sir John Hawkwood's White Company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of thought that mercenaries formed in the Italian city-states because, as you said, the city-states were so wealthy, but also because they were rather small.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't kind of have the human resources to raise a standing army. So
yeah, that was one of the reasons why the Romans started to use mercenaries. It's because, one of them was they started to lack the manpower to keep the standing army. As the empire becomes bigger, you need more men. Yeah.
Well, as we said,
and also people don't want to do that job.
Yeah.
Yeah, very true.
Plus, when we did, legionaries, if you're just, you kind of have that brutality of that animalism where you kind of don't quit. Yeah, I can see we're all out of men because they all just charged and died. Great, what do we do now?
Actually, the legionaries became quite mercenary in and of themselves because they became quite common for when the new emperor would come. He would easily just buy the soldiers by doubling their pay and that, just crippled the empire. But then it became an expectation.
Mm.
So they would go to whoever would pay the most.
Kind of like a bonus at a Japanese company. It's an expectation.
Yeah, until recently.
Yeah. Well, and then, yeah.
Kind of like lifelong employment. Not anymore. So the first element, and probably the most obvious element, and it's where the Condottieri got their name, is from the word contract. And their name actually means like contractors.
Hmm.
Yeah. So the first element from this is condotta, which means contract. Count the number of times they say contract. Yeah. If you can get to 50, you win a prize. Yeah. So, yeah, obviously that's the most important thing, I think, about a mercenary is what we call, show me the money.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because essentially that's all they're working for. Like, I was thinking about it, and...
That in the weekend.
Oh, jeez.
Any Loverboy fans out there? No?
No.
In Canada, Friday comes, and every radio station's got playing, working for the weekend.
Because I was thinking, doing the research, mercenaries, they pretty much only work for money, right? I didn't say it was going to be profound.
No, sorry, I was going in the weekend.
Oh, all right. I'll do that second moment. Because think about it, mercenaries pretty much only work for money, because as soon as you start fighting for another reason, you pretty much cease to be a mercenary. Like, if you're forced to do it to work off a debt or for some reason, then
a slave soldier or something?
Slave soldier, conscript, right? You're working something off. If you're following an ideal...
Working something off. What are you, like a rageaholic or something?
Maybe.
or you're a little chubby. We're just working off the gut. I'm on the three battle diet.
No, but if you fight for like an ideal, either like a revolutionary or a terrorist, depending on where you fall, you know, if you fight for your country, then you're just a regular soldier. So pretty much the only thing you're fighting for is personal gain and yourself, if you're a mercenary, which I think is kind of one of the key points to this.
Right.
Yeah, it's actually one of the things that I was reading is about how this is more modern, not so much with back in the Renaissance era, but how the United Nations considers fighting armies and mercenaries. And actually what you said there, when somebody who just decides, I'm going to go and fight for my country, say if there's a war on, they're not an actual soldier, then they're classified as a mercenary and they can be tried as such, like they could be tried for murder.
Yeah, I heard the Gurkhas don't actually aren't technically classified as mercenaries, according to the UN.
Yeah, the Gurkhas even, in the French Foreign Legion, yeah.
Yeah, even though they meet a lot of the criteria for being a mercenary. Mm-hmm. You know, fighting for money.
No.
No, we fight for love of money.
we fight for the love of
the
money.
The ideal of being rich. But, yeah, I really like what you can do with the contract. Because and I think a game that does a really good job with contracts is BattleTech. Mm. And it's certainly a part of their fiction and their world. So they have the Mercenary Review and Bonding Commission, which is based on a planet called Outreach. I think you can do a lot with something like that, with some sort of commission or some body that oversees all of the different mercenary groups that are in your world.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And because if you have a contract, what are some interesting stories that you can tell there? Of course, you can do all the battles and the fighting, but then you can also have all of the terms and conditions. And what would constitute a breach of contract, both on the employer side or on the mercenary side? Like any good story, it's not the good times that are fun to tell. It is the bad times. So for a mercenary, probably one of the worst things that can happen to them, I mean, the normal times are the battles.
Hmm.
But the special times or the extraordinary times is when either they break the contract or their employer breaks the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can do that just one-on-one and there's certainly a lot you can do with that. But if you have a commission, then you can tell a completely different story. Mm-hmm. Like they can go to this commission and it's almost like a legal drama, or the commission, I mean, could send somebody out to get them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's like one of the more famous mercenary companies, and this predates the Condottieri by hundreds of years, is the 10,000, and they're Greek mercenaries, and they were fighting in Persia, and they were successful, but unfortunately the man that hired them got killed, and the whole reason for being there was to put that guy on the throne, Cyprus the Younger, on the throne. So now they don't have an employer, they don't have a purpose for being there. They try to quickly get some contracts, that doesn't work out. So then they've got like to flee, or flee retreat. As fast as a 10,000 hoplites. fighting withdrawal out of there. And if you don't, I mean, I'm sure that sounds really exciting, but you can just watch the movie The Warriors, which is basically a retelling of this story set in late 70s New York.
I didn't think of that, but now that you mention it, yeah.
And that's amazing. Instead of 10,000, there's 9.
Yeah.
I think there was a 10,000 gang members, wouldn't be much of a, all right, we're just going to walk out of here. All right, that's cool.
Can 10,000 really walk? Is it more of like a swarm?
Yeah, we're going to swarm back to Coney Island. Yeah.
Yeah, you go right on ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need direction?
Yeah.
No,
but.
Sorry, just to finish that point. I know I'm going on too long here, but here you could have the commission. I mean, there you can have it just organically happen. It's just the army that you're fighting suddenly is now
on your side.
Actually, what I was going to say was probably even dumber than that. It was like, the army that you were fighting is now fighting you even more.
Wait a minute, how did that work? Well, I signed a contract that said, you must fight harder. Oh, crap, you came up with that one.
I don't know, maybe you look vulnerable, so you got to fight it, get out of there. But you could have it where the commission then is like, you broke the contract, therefore all these other mercenary companies are going to come after you because our reputation as mercenaries depends on everybody following the contract.
Yeah.
So then they dispatch other mercenary companies to come and get you. And, it can be like the Warriors, you're running out of there.
Yeah. through the streets of New York.
Through the streets of New York, yeah. And you wear little leather vests.
Yeah.
Shirts. Shirts optional.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was going to say, I'm glad you brought up like the contract and the negotiation, because I think a mercenary company would be an interesting party because of all the roles you need in it. Like, obviously, you have to fight because you're mercenaries. But contract, you do contract negotiations, which introduces an opportunity for, like, the face character. Mercenary companies work on their own, which means they have to, like, resupply and, you know, repair their own stuff, which brings in a role for, like, the skill monkey type character. Mm-hmm. Basically, any type of character would fit into a mercenary company because of all the contracts and the stuff they have to do besides fighting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you think about your traditional adventuring party, and the king just says, well, we have a problem, you know, orcs are raiding, and it's like, well, you know, this is what heroes do. We fight stuff like that. Great, great, done. But with a mercenary company, that suddenly, there's a lot of give and take. And if you have a social character, then that's their time to step up and negotiate the terms and play, and then, you know, they separate, come together, like a lot of stuff that you can do there. So it's like every step of the adventure suddenly becomes interesting, suddenly becomes something that there's always going to be a conflict.
And you can get a lot of variety in the adventures as well, because if you're playing like a military campaign, you know, you're an infantryman, then you go out and you fight. That's what infantry does. If there's something specialized that they need done, they have a specialist for that. But in a mercenary company, you don't always have that option. You know, one day you might be just kind of a grunt fighting on the field, but the next day you might have to spy or infiltrate someplace. So there's lots of things to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also gives the game master a little bit of justification for really tailoring certain situations to the player's strengths and what their interests are, because sometimes certain city states or countries, they hire what they need. So if they need a particular group, a particular type of warrior, then they're going to hire that. So it's almost like, you know.
Well, I also see it kind of the other side of the coin, where it's a chance for the group of player characters and players to really think about why they're special, you know? If countries and city-states and corporations only hire what they need, great. Why would someone hire you? What is it you do as a group that other groups don't do? What do you specialize in? Or at least, why are you good?
Yeah, and the mercenary captain, quite common, we called, or even that face character, they've got to verbalize it. Not only, like, why are you special, but if you've got to sell yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So then the players have to think about, okay, why are we special, and how can we pitch that? And that gets them thinking. Remember we talked, I think it was the Friday Night Lights episode, where we talked about, you know, like little chants and things that we can say, you know, just kind of get you in the mood of the game, and then them just thinking and writing out is like, this is what we say, this is who we are. And a lot of, you know, adventuring companies or vampire clans or whatever, they don't think about saying what they are. They think about doing it and role-playing certain situations, but they're often not, you know, why are you good? Why are you here?
I want to play the game. I want to play the game. Not good enough. Come up with a better one.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to pay you anything.
Yeah.
Why should we pay?
We need the money. That's our check. We need the money!
Imagine a game ending. It's just like they can't negotiate, and you don't get the contract. And they're like, but...
Sorry.
Do better next time.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll see you guys next Thursday.
Yeah. In my house.
No, I could see that in like a sandbox game, because, you know, again, doing the research for this, a lot of times what would happen, at least maybe not towards the end of sort of the idea of, or the period of the mercenary, but if you didn't get the contract, if you were between contracts, you essentially became brigands, right? Because, I mean, not all the time, but you have all these people you need to feed and money that you need to pay them. And if you don't have a contract, if you don't have an income, then the mercenary company is going to start to break up, or you're going to stick together as a group and turn to something that's maybe not so legal.
Yeah,
you
know? I mean,
absolutely. Exactly as you're saying, Wink. The condottieri, they were described as like roving bands of brigands before they started organizing themselves into an actual mercenary force. And a lot of them were desperate. The war was over, and they didn't have a supply of money or anything anymore. They couldn't feed themselves. So if you don't get that contract, there's a possibility that you don't eat. Or if you're in a larger mercenary company and you don't get the contract, then perhaps your employees start getting, you know, angry that they're not getting paid, and they've got guns. So
yeah, I mean, I mean, there's a few ways to go there. I mean, you could try to extort a contract out of somebody by ravaging the countryside. Mm. And I mean, they're aware of the situation. It's like, you know, I mean, obviously, we can't have this armed group of men. Mm-hmm. So we'll give them a contract, at least get them to do something. Or you could just be where you are living off the land. We see that there's a movie called, a Michael Caine movie called The Last Valley. Mm. It's based on a novel. And yeah, there is that constant tension between you got to keep your men motivated, you got to keep them fed, and they're just like, you know, raping and pillaging different places. Mm-hmm. And then they get to this valley. I'm not ruining the plot. I mean, it's
called
the beginning.
The valley.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, it's the last one too.
Yeah. Is the last unicorn there?
And, you know, kind of the negotiation with the village. And it's like, well, why don't you preserve the village and use that to get you through the winter. And that's like the premise of the last valley. It's like they decide to like, they stop there and to winter. And yeah, they're like, there's just much more that you can do. And I mean, that's a bit amoral, I suppose you could say, or even immoral. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that again is what a mercenary company allows you to do. I mean, there's a lot of different things that are involved in playing the mercenary company above and beyond like a normal adventurer. Now, of course, what do you call them? Wayne, murder hobos? Or
I did not coin that phrase. I heard it somewhere else. I just thought it was funny. Yeah, murder hobos.
Right. But also people talk about the old joke, Monty Hall. They go into the dungeon and they
need like 10 mules to carry out all the found.
Yeah.
But with the mercenary company, I mean, they can, and this is big in BattleTech, they negotiate salvage rights. Mm. Right. So not only could you be in that desperate situation where you're just trying to feed your men and just pillaging, but then, I was going to say pillaging and raping, but I'm like, it's not really feeding. I guess it's feeding something in the men.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Nice save, Lau.
Yeah, it's smooth as silk.
But yeah, you can get the salvage rights, and yeah, I think, I don't know, because it's like in a contract, it just, for some reason that makes it more real to me than just going into a dungeon, just stripping it bare. It's like strip mining a dungeon.
Yeah. But I mean, like, speaking of salvage rights, like, yeah, mercenary, we tend to think of like, you know, medieval fantasy Europe, so D&D style games, but you don't even have to be like fighters per se, because even in like science fiction, there's a lot of salvage right contracts, you know, and you kind of have these like independent companies or independent contract crews that go out and either mine asteroids or, you know, pick up salvage from ships or space battles, or in eclipse phase, they collect asteroids, you know, or comets for the volatiles and water on them. Yeah. And they have contracts and, you know, they have these salvage rights. And I mean, you could go into combat. I mean, there's dispute over who has, you know, rights over this or who got there first. But I mean, there's other stuff you can do with mercenaries and contracts that isn't necessarily armed conflict.
Oh yeah, I mean, you could even have like mercenary explorer corps.
Mm.
And yeah, part of the thing that sweetens the deal is they get to salvage things that they find, but they also have to map it or whatever. Yeah,
I think of like wormhole gates, because again, my catchphrase is Eclipse Face has it, right? You have those Pandora gates. They contract people to go out, go through these gates and tell us, yeah, what's on the other side? Mm-hmm. I mean, you send through drones first, of course, so you don't just like end up in nowhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. And you do have some kind of right, you know, either it's like there's something on that planet and you have some kind of claim on it, or you get a piece of that planet or I guess like stock in it or something. So again, there's a lot you can do with contracts that isn't fighting.
Yeah, and historically, espionage was a large subset of mercenary work, and some of it was not salvage rights, but if you got any additional information outside of what you were contracted for, you could use that to sell yourself.
Hmm. And again, there's the social character. Hey, here's the stuff you wanted. Got some extra too, but let's negotiate.
It'll cost you extra.
Yeah.
And then the other element that a contract can add is like, who's your employer? So you could be employed by the king, you know, against the
cardinal,
the orc hordes, or the cardinal. Yes, it's going with the orc hordes.
All right.
Or you could be employed by the orc hordes, who needs like a disciplined, hard hitting unit, or a bunch of little specialists, probably more in keeping with the role playing game.
Yeah.
Yeah. So really, they hire
you. What self-respecting greenskin is going to like hire services of like a human mercenary company to teach them how to fight? Really?
I said discipline.
All right. But like I kind of said at the beginning, I think that's the key point. Like, for me, if you're going to play a mercenary, that means you will work for whoever pays you, regardless of who that employer is, or regardless of whether you agree with the ideology or whatever of those people that employ you. Mm-hmm. If you kind of say, well, I'm only going to really work for like the good guy and he's going to pay me, well, then you're not, in my opinion at least, you're not really a mercenary, right?
Well, I'm...
Okay, technically maybe you are.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
But then you're not really embracing, you know,
right,
you're
not, okay, how about that? Yeah, you're not embracing the sort of, you're not embracing the mercenary spirit,
yeah. You know?
Because there is a reason why mercenary has a negative connotation to the word in general.
Could it be they work for money?
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. That was a rhetorical question to prove my point.
So that gets into our next element, and that's amico nemico, which is friend or enemy, friend info. Yeah. And that's, which means like your friend today could be your enemy tomorrow, your enemy.
Could be your friend next week. Again.
Yeah. We can go and we can switch. Yeah. So, which is a strange dynamic. So we're used to maybe more black and white, you know. I mean, a lot of worlds are, or a lot of games are based around, you know, here, you open the book and they say, here are who the players are. They play these guys. And maybe they have kind of rivalries with these other playing races or playing templates. But you're all kind of on the same team. Yeah. And your enemy is the Tenocracy. Or your enemy is orcs. Your enemies are the pure.
Whatever's in that DMG, you know?
Yeah. And here it's like, all right, whoever. Yeah.
Your enemy is whoever the guy who paid you says it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's a chance that it's also other members of your same mercenary group. That was actually quite common back in the medieval period. For example, the German, what were they called? Landsknecht, I think it was land knights in English. But yeah, it wasn't odd at all for them to be on both sides of the battle.
Yeah, I mean, the Persians hired Greeks to invade Greece. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess what we're confused is not like a company
that
would
splits and then fight itself.
That's, that's exactly what I'm saying. The same mercenary company would hire to both sides of the battle.
I suppose so long as you didn't die in the fighting, you would make double the money.
That was one of the things with the condottieri, was that by their downfall, a lot of the times they weren't fighting at all. They'd have these big theatrical battles with almost no bloodshed at all. And kind of the military started asking, or the government started asking, why are we paying you guys to fight for us if you're not actually fighting? But it was because of it. Like, they traded soldiers between the different groups so often that, you know, the guy you're working with today, you could be fighting against tomorrow, but you're both working for the same person.
So it's like a draft or like professional sports, you know?
Yeah.
This season you're on, you know, one team, and the next one you're on the other team, and you're expected to play just as hard, but...
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I never assumed that people from the same company would fight each other. I thought maybe more was like separate companies who are all under this umbrella of mercenary, and we all fight this way, and we kind of have something of a connection or a little bit of like a brotherhood because we're both mercenaries, so let's kind of play act at fighting a little bit so we don't waste our resources, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think Machiavelli identified as like, they're never going to do that spirited charge or risk it all to try to win the battle because they don't get paid if they die.
Mm.
Yeah.
So they're never going to do anything too reckless.
Right.
So then they kind of developed a style of fighting where it was, it wasn't as brutal or wasn't as savage as it was, as it would have been if it was like revolutionaries fighting or soldiers fighting for the country.
Yeah.
It kind of gets back to like money. Like, what good is having money if you're dead? You know, you fight for an idea. The idea may live on in something else. You know, you kind of win even though you're dead. You're like, money? Great. What does that do?
Yeah.
But I could see that as really like driving home the idea of the player characters are a mercenary company, right? Because especially in D&D, if the player characters just murder hobos, right? You send them up against people from another mercenary company, and if the PCs slaughter these guys, well, great. The next encounter is a representative from that, you know, company saying, hey, look, we're all mercenaries here. you just kind of cost us a lot of money. Could we maybe not do that next time? You know, you're going to have to pay us for the stuff you essentially broke. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it wouldn't.
And
that
then
would
kill him.
Well, exactly. Then they kill him. You know, if they're that bloodthirsty.
I'm not sure that. I think mercenaries would fight each other just as savagely as they would fight, like fighting. Mm-hmm. If the mercenary company was fighting soldiers, I don't imagine they'd hold back because it's another mercenary company.
But another mercenary company is probably more open to cost-effective measures. That's again why bribes were so common back then. It cost less money for the company to bribe the opposing army than it did to retrain and re-equip troops. And so, I mean, it sounds very realistic. You know, if you meet another mercenary group and you slaughter them all, then why wouldn't the company come meet you and say, hey, can we just pay you guys off?
You've slaughtered them all. Sorry.
Well, yeah. I was about to say the same thing, too.
The first encounter was slaughtering them all. The second encounter was...
So who's left? You slaughtered them all. I'm just like, I'm not following this story.
The group that you encounter, not the entire company.
Sorry, I imagine it kind of like tips of the iceberg.
Oh, I see.
I wonder, as a motivation, we keep talking about money, is it? But I think that a lot of mercenaries would also be motivated by that's just what they do. That's their job. A lot of the modern mercenaries, like Blackwater and Sandline and such, they're people who've been in the military, you know, since they were teenagers, and now that they're retiring from the military, they just don't know how to do anything but fight.
I suppose. I mean, loving your job is a motivation, right?
But I love my killing.
But I was going to say, for the average person, no matter what kind of job you're in, I tend to think the idea of having a job is to make money. So you can say, I love this job for the pay it gives me. Mm-hmm. Right.
I think a lot of those guys that go to Blackwater, I mean, if you...
Careful, we don't want to lose the Blackwater listeners.
Yeah. No, we don't want to insult them.
Yeah.
Didn't they change their name anyway?
Yeah, there's something else.
It's like an X or something.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. We're going to forget that you murder people. Anyway. Well, they're not going to kill me unless somebody pays them.
How much do you think you're worth?
No, but I'm going to disagree when you're talking about, like... Blackwater, I think that's their skill set is they have these military skills, but mm-hmm. I think they go into something like an organization like Blackwater because it's more lucrative.
Yeah,
you know, they go into the private sector and they make more money. And it could be just like a police officer might take early retirement, or upon their normal retirement, they go and work for Walmart security force. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I forget the head of Walmart security. He actually might be CIA or something, ex-CIA. But he's probably making a lot more money than he's working for Walmart.
Yeah,
I think that's it. Because if you take someone with that skill set, if they don't care about money, why wouldn't they just join whatever the army equivalent is for their country? Point of that is, I think. Going to the private sector means you want the money.
Yeah. Although BattleTech...
Does it matter?
Yeah. Uh-huh. The BattleTech, when they talk about the mercenaries, and they're saying it's like, on average, they make this many credits.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I mean, it's BattleTech money. But they're saying that's about the equivalent of actually like a blue-collar worker in their universe. So they say one of the big motivations is that you're your own boss, and there's like a freedom. Being part of a mercenary company that you don't get working for a company or working for the army or the military. And also some people do like the glory of fighting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a character concept that you can play with. But you're absolutely right, though. If somebody just had that skill set, then they could, you know, go and be a Walmart guard for a lot more safety. Not job security, life security.
Mm-hmm. So it gets into our next element, which is reputation. Which is reputation.
Yeah, as you couldn't tell.
Yeah. Or was it reputazione? I think it's reputazione.
Okay. I'm not the one who said it the first time.
But it's still reputation.
The word hasn't changed in how many hundreds of years, and we're not going to change it now.
Yeah. The English is still the same. And, I mean, that reputation is really important. I mean, both good and bad, obviously. And just... another thing that we would want people to consider if they are going to do like a mercenary company is to give it a cool name. And actually, these examples are not really going to support that when I say.
So pick a cooler name than the ones Lyle's going to suggest.
Yeah. So, I mean, these ones are historic from history, but do better than The Great Company. Do better than
10,000.
That's kind of cool. Do better than the White Company. Well, there's the Company of St. George. That's okay. But probably the two most famous companies are the Great Company and the White Company. The White Company led, again, by that Sir John Hawkwood. I think he was knighted by the Black Prince.
Keeping in the color theme.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I didn't even connect that. And the Great Company was led by Werner von Urschlingen. And I guess he had this breastplate, and it said, I guess they said it engraved on it was the enemy of God, of pity, and of mercy. Which is pretty badass.
That's a pretty badass reputation. All right. Oh. I'm guessing he wasn't hired by the people who said, yeah, we just want you to scare him a little bit.
One of the practices of those German Lantern Knights that they got together around the time of the arquebus and the musketeers, so there were actually firearms, but the firearms were still weak enough that they wouldn't go through a heavy plate of armor. So they would test the plate of armor by firing a pistol into it, and then they would, like, laminate around the bullet hole to show that their armor could stave off bullets, and that was one of their call signs, which I thought was also pretty badass.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Unfortunately, once the once firearms got better,
that just turned into a target.
Yeah, no, that was one of the downfalls of these great mercenary companies is that they didn't really adapt their tactics. They still like to stay with the heavy man at arms.
Yeah.
Both mounted and unmounted. So, you know, like we're saying about developing a pitch, you know, what makes you great? But I think it'd be a lot of fun is like giving your group a fun name. I mean, you know, BattleTech has some classic mercenary companies such as Wolf's Dragoons and Kell's Hounds.
Hmm. Yeah. Game of Thrones is a good one too.
They're very historical. Like the Golden Company is very similar to, well, the White Company.
All right. Yeah. Sorry, there's only so many colors, and they all use the word company, you know.
The Fuchsia Company.
The Red Shanks, Scottish group, also a color.
Yeah. It's so fun. Yeah, Blackwater. Wow. Wow, that's a long line of history. But, you know, I don't know if you ever thought about if you ever started a band.
Right.
What you would name your band? Well, now you don't need to learn how to play guitar. You just get your mercenary company in a role-playing game.
All you need to do is just learn how to play that broadsword. There you go.
Has anyone taken the cure? Not for a mercenary company. Yeah, that's right.
Odd name for a mercenary company. Are you like Hospitallers or something?
No, the cure? That's badass.
That's just cold stuff. I like that.
Yeah. Right. There you go.
Outvoted.
Right. Yeah. The Smiths, maybe not so good. Right.
Metallica? Iron Maiden? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Justin Bieber? No.
Let's just keep naming bands. All right.
Coldplay.
Coldplay would be not bad. Yeah. Not bad. There you go. I mean, I think that could be you could have a lot of fun with that. It's just taking real bands.
And then you have to choose a song from that band to play when you march onto the field. Yeah, there you go.
How about The Band? That'd be cool.
Yeah. Very meta.
Yeah.
The Company. Whoa, 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 whoa. What color?
Pace
no, just The Company.
Yeah. Or beyond color.
But along with choosing a name, like, I do like the idea of reputation for, like, a group of PCs, because then they kind of have to, it's not an alignment, you know, but you do kind of have to pick a way that, yeah, you're going to present yourself to the rest of the world, you know, and once, I like it because sort of once that ball gets rolling, it's going to be really hard to change direction, you know? Mm-hmm. If you're known for, like, you know, never breaking a contract, well, then something comes up, you're going to try your absolute hardest to make sure you complete that contract so you can continue with that reputation. Because as soon as one contract gets broken, you don't have that reputation anymore.
Absolutely,
Or if you always have, like, a reputation for, like, being, you know, incredibly violent on the battlefield, well, that could be great, but it could also be pretty negative, you know? It's a double-edged sword. So it'll get you work with some people, but other people might say, you know what, no, we're not going to hire you because you are too violent, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And some people really enjoy, I mean, people who play, for example, Necromunda. Like, why would you play Necromunda over something like 40k?
Because you need less minis?
Yeah, well, there's that. As soon as I started saying, I was like, ah, yeah, somebody's going to mention that. But one thing was the kind of the campaign of this gang moving on and buying and selling stuff. And the same as like BattleTech, I think people who play the mercenary companies, one of the things that they really enjoy is, you know, acquiring salvage and the economics of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And you take reputation. Reputation, you can make that as part of the mechanics of the negotiation.
Mm.
If your reputation is damaged, then you have to work that much harder in the negotiations. And it could be as simple as just a plus or a minus to rolls, if that's what you want to do. But it could also be you could make a table and things like that. And there are games out there. I mean, there are, again, like BattleTech does have a lot of rules for playing mercenary companies. And, I mean, there was a book out during the D20 time, or the D20 boom, and it was called Mercenaries by AEG.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting book. It focuses on fantasy.
Mm.
That was good.
That's pretty thick. I was thinking, like the idea of having to rebuild a damaged reputation, because, again, it would involve everybody at the table, right? You need the face guy to negotiate even that much harder because your reputation is damaged. But then that also translates to, okay, we got this contract, and now we got to live up to it. We got to do 120%. That means, you know, the fighters, they've got to make sure everything gets done. You're going to want the equipment to be in tip-top shape, meaning the skill guys have to make sure everything is, you know, performing at peak efficiency. Mm-hmm. It's another one of those things where everybody at the table is going to be involved in the role that's sort of specialized for their character, but then also as a group. You know, that's, again, I guess a great place for someone to, like, step up and fill a role that they maybe wouldn't normally fill. Because, okay, now we've negotiated this contract, we've got to make sure we give 110%. Great, the fighter's down. We can't, he's incapacitated. We can't lose this contract, you know? This is sort of our next to last chance. Someone else has to step up and kind of be a hero. I mean, it's a little less heroic than stepping up because you need to be a hero, because in the end you're kind of stepping up for personal gain. But it is sort of similar. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, it gives your players another motivation, and that can be a big thing, a big factor in making a game fun is different motivations. Mm-hmm. If the motivation is constantly, we got to do what's right, or if the motivation is just we got to just acquire more power, or, you know, anything that it can just be samey and just like but now it's like, okay, now your reputation is damaged.
Mm.
You got all that money, you're able to break the contract and escape, but now your name is mud.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives the players the opportunity to try to do things to repair that damage. And if you want to do a very sandbox game, then it allows them to like try different things, but they have that motivation because this is gone. You can't really get any contracts. You're going to get contracts at a massive discount because nobody trusts you.
Yeah.
So.
Or even it allows them the GM, or it allows the players to sort of try different things, or allows the GM to kind of put the players in situations that they wouldn't normally be, because, as you said, you now have a crappy reputation, which means you're going to get the crappy jobs that, hey, maybe that's not really what you trained for, but that's all you can get. And so you're going to have to do it. And, again, the motivation is the same.
Yeah.
You know, the end goal is the same, but, you know, wanting to get that reputation or money to get the bigger contracts, but how you get there is going to be different. If the group has always been sort of like, I guess, the fighting company, right?
Yeah.
Where they just fight. Great. You're hired for an escort job because that's all you could get. And so now you just have to protect this person. Or you're hired for the espionage one. And now you can't just go in and fight. You have to sneak in, get information, and get out because that's the only job you could get.
It's really good. A couple of things that come to mind. One is Spartacus in the first season, where he has to fight in the pits?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of like a very small gladiator pit.
Underground,
yeah. And, it's not a huge leap, but it shows where like the story can diverge, and you force the players down a level.
Mm.
And then the other thing that comes to mind is like sometimes you like telling those stories, like you said, like the escorts or like a really small scale story. But then as your players increase in power, you kind of feel that you have to ratchet up the story. And maybe they save the world at some point. Mm-hmm. And then it's almost like, well, what are they going to save next? The solar system? You know,
Megaverse!
The Megaverse, yeah. You always feel like, I got to keep topping it. I got to keep topping myself. And you watch that in something like Supernatural. Mm-hmm. It's a great TV series, but there's like they keep having to, every season, they seem to go up a level. And the reputation is a way to bring it back down. Mm. Okay, yeah, you did this, but you destroyed your reputation. So, yeah, now you were telling a smaller story. And the player's like, what? Because that's where your reputation is now.
Yeah, because you screwed up that last one.
Yeah.
You're down here now.
Yeah, and that allows you to like maybe do things with that small story that is going to be a refreshing change of pace. Like they're not looking for that one sword that's going to kill that Demon King to save the entire continent.
Now they're looking for that one pearl that's missing from that one local, you know, noblewoman's tiara.
To kill that.
No, to put together that killer outfit for the ball next week. There you go. Oh,
yeah. All right.
Nice. I just tried to work kill in there somewhere.
You could take the same kind of adventures, just bring it down a level. You know, maybe they screwed up a bit, so instead of being the ones to go in and fight whatever monster it is, maybe they're being forced to be subordinate to some other commander who is more trusted than the group is. Or you could go the opposite direction as well. Maybe their reputation is fantastic, so good that espionage becomes a real liability because everybody knows who they are.
Yep. Now you can definitely take it the other way. I'm going to go back to the original. Because it just reminded me of a situation in your campaign, Chris, where our players had established themselves at a certain level of reputation as like heroes.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then it was like, but we're heroes. You know, it's like, we're going to get at certain accommodations.
Yeah.
But if your reputation gets shattered, then it's like, now you're back to doing the dirty dozen work. You know, you're doing the grunt work.
Imagine how cool that would be for the correct player group. It's like, great, you're returned from wherever, and hey, all your stuff is outside of your rooms, just on the street. You're like, what the heck happened here? You know, your reputation's down. King's like, yeah, I don't want you here anymore. Get out. I at least think that'd be pretty cool.
Well, actually, I tried doing that in my campaign. It just didn't work all that well. Where after a while, you guys kind of outlived your invitation to stay for free at the local hotel. Then you're able to convince the king to let you stay in the castle. So it worked out.
I didn't really pick that up.
I just bring it back to the battlefield. The mercenary company's reputation waxed and waned, and it can go from one to the other. Like the Swiss Guards at one point were the height of popularity, and everybody wanted to hire the Swiss Guards until people could start defeating the Swiss Guards, and then their reputation, you know, fell.
Actually, you know, it's kind of interesting. The very same tactics from the, I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce this right, but the Epitoma Re Militiari. Is that right?
Epitoma Re Militiari.
Yeah. That book was a book of the Roman fighting tactics that the Swiss based their formations on, but it's actually other tactics from the same book that eventually outfought them from the Dutch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that brings us to our final element, and that's Epitoma Re Militiari, or like military science.
Just a side note here, the next Warriors episode, can we do something based in, an English-speaking country? So we don't have to butcher these points?
So military science, and I, that actually links to something that we talked about earlier when we talked about amico nemico, friend and foe, when, you know, as Chris said, the battles were kind of almost like elaborate plays, play acting. But they're actually in an effort to try to reduce the amount of bloodshed on at least on their side.
Right.
They started to adopt different types of tactics, or started to explore like military science a bit, so that they could defeat the enemy without, you know, just a frontal assault.
Well, it makes sense because a mercenary company is effectively a business,
right?
And you know, if you just essentially like throw money at a problem, well, you're probably not going to stay in business very long, you know? So what I mean is, if your entire force are getting decimated each time you fight, you're going to have to pay to retrain, re-equip, resupply, do all these things, and now you're effectively, you have no money, you're not making a profit. So it kind of just makes sense to find a way to fight the enemy that will essentially save you the most money.
Yeah. You know, it just reminded me that a common military company around the about this time was the artillery companies and the artillerists. Maybe not so much the company, but the actual, like...
Soldier?
We wouldn't call him soldier, but I guess engineer.
Mm.
Because they knew how to, you know, they knew the science behind firing these cannons effectively and how to, like, cast them and that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a way to get really rich. I guess they, you know, they make a lot of money but lose a lot of money or spend a lot of money. But but it just goes to show you can be, like, hyper-specialized and you can still kind of play in this military, or sorry, mercenary-style game. I mean, you could be, like, a mage mercenary.
Yeah, imagine that. Yeah. Like, that would kind of ties a little, I guess, a little into reputation. Ties into everything, because... Imagine if you were a company of mages.
Yeah, I had the same idea. How cool, huh?
Yeah, a mercenary company of mages. You could command, like, top dollar, you know? But then, I guess tying back into the point of reputation, then as soon as you lose, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah.
You know, your reputation is shattered. Right? I guess like, the higher you climb, the farther you can fall. You know?
Mm-hmm. Imagine if you were, like, a mage in a mercenary company, and it's like it's almost like those mafia doctors.
Mm.
Something happened.
Yeah.
That led you to this situation, why you're, like, performing these back-alley surgeries. And it's like the mercenary company made, just like, something happened to you that, you know, that means that you're here, not in some wizard's tower studying, or not, you know, some advisor to the king.
Oh, that reminded me of the character in Game of Thrones, sort of the Fallen Maester.
Oh, yes.
Qyburn.
Yeah.
You know, and... He's in this company of really despicable people.
The Brave Companions. Yeah,
and you're just, those guys have an absolutely terrible reputation. And you kind of figure out he's a maester. And when you find that out, the thought going through your head is, what did this guy do where where the only choice left to him is to be a part of this outrageously despicable company?
Yeah.
And what does he do to survive in this company? You know,
you gotta earn your keep.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, I probably don't want to know what he did, you know? Yeah.
Actually, the Bloody Mummers, it gets back into reputation. Because not only, they call themselves the Brave Companions, but everybody else calls them the Bloody Mummers because of their reputation. But that's a way that you, as the game master, can play with it. You know, let the players come up with this grandiose name for themselves.
And then you come up with a crappy one for them.
Yeah. But based upon their actions, you know? I mean, if they're, like, very noble, then you could give them some sort of mocking noble, you know, pure of heart, you know, the pure hearts or something like that. And they're like, well, that's not very badass. Like, that's what people call you, the virgin, you know.
That's what people
say. The virgin blades or something like that.
Because you never drum, you never fight.
Yeah. And that can kind of galvanize the players to do something. You know?
Possibly leave your game.
Yeah. But, yeah, and again, the military science, and this harkens back to something that Wayne brought up at the beginning, is just like all these different types of characters that you can have in this group. I mean, science fiction, you can have all of these like real science kind of guys, but I mean, the idea is that they're going to do whatever it takes to do well in business. And a lot of business is about working with your head, not with your hands.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's something that we can take from that.
Fight smart, not hard.
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's actually goes into something. A lot of the armies back in medieval Europe, and actually later on Renaissance Europe as well, they had the idea of this is the way to fight. You know, we march our armies against one another in a big field and then they fight. But, you know, the mercenaries, they couldn't do that. They couldn't do conscriptions and drafting, so they needed to figure out better ways around it.
Yeah, I mean, the concept of the total war, you know, that became really popular in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Popular. Used a lot in the 20th century. People loved it. People loved total war. Couldn't get enough of it.
You guys want to do a total war today? Yeah, I'm in.
But that became really common in the Hundred Years' War because they would... For a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons was to destroy your enemy's ability to fight.
Mm.
So these companies, or even just the main army, would send out a little force to kind of like what they call a reconnoitering force or whatever, and they would, you know, take all the food or destroy it, you know, mm-hmm. kill the peasants so they can't grow any more food. So this concept, and this gets into the military science, is like if a mercenary company, you know, figures out, it's like, well, all we really just need to defeat them somehow. We don't necessarily need to defeat them on the field of battle, so we'll just go and pillage and rape and do all these sort of things, you know, just like heroes do. As soon as I said that, I guess, maybe not rape. Don't do the rape.
I think that kind of gets back to the negative connotation that mercenaries have, right? Like
the regular troops did the same thing.
I'm not saying they didn't. All I'm saying is, like, in the context of a game, right, especially D&D or other fantasy games, you usually play the hero.
Yeah.
Can you really be, quote-unquote, the hero if you're in a mercenary company? Right? You can be good, definitely, right? You can honor that contract. And I guess you can be moral up to a point. But will you ever really be the hero? You know?
Because if you follow the idea of the mercenary that we laid out earlier, that it is all about the money, then not really, no. I mean, if the orcs hire you, it's unlikely you're going to be picking flowers for them.
Hey,
well, let's see. If we look at the elements that we picked out, to be a mercenary, you can be business savvy.
Mm-hmm.
So you got the contract. You can be open-minded, friend or foe, doesn't matter. You can be whatever people say you are, whatever you think you are in reputation. And you can be smart with, like, the military science. But can you be a hero? And probably the answer is not conventionally.
Yeah. If we redefine the word, you can be a hero.
Yeah. I mean, you could do, like you suggested earlier, Wayne, to where you only take the contracts that are quote-unquote good, or, you know, you build up a really sterling reputation as only the good guys so that you're only offered those. But, again, that's kind of defeating the spirit by following the letter.
Right.
It is. And because I was thinking, like, if the GM, you know, like, says, oh, these are the only contracts you can get, right?
Yeah.
And they're all pretty despicable.
Right.
That's kind of like the GM is kind of like shoehorning you, you know, forcing you to make a bad choice when you didn't really deserve it.
Right.
But I was just thinking, like, as soon as kind of you turn the contract down, or as soon as, like, the PC group, like, leaves the mercenary company because they don't agree to the terms of whatever contract they're part of, well, then you've kind of stopped being mercenaries and now you are kind of heroes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well,
I was thinking when you said what the different contracts you can offer, and there's different types, definitely, that you can offer. And yeah, from good to bad, you know, despicable. But there's also, like, ones that are involving you doing garrison duty.
Hmm.
And there's a big trade-off. It's boring, and there's less reward. Or there's other in battle, which are very dangerous. But I think you really got to play with that. It's really got to be dangerous. And with garrison duty, nobody's going to want to interrupt your game week after week.
Yeah, right.
Doing nothing. So then you've got to play with, you know, maybe make it more political. Mm. There's assassinations going on, more investigation. So again, a mercenary company allows you to really change up the style of game. Mm-hmm. And the players can have some choice in what style they want to play for the next 2 months based on what kind of contracts they choose.
I hadn't thought about that, but as soon as you said that, yeah, that could really, that's a very, I like that. That's an in-game way for the GM to say, you tell me what style of game you want to play.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll provide these contracts, you know, in-game, and then whatever one you pick, great, that's kind of the type of game we're playing, at least until the contract runs out.
Yeah.
Which will be, you know, a variable amount of time. Actually, I really like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is a slight downside that it kind of takes a little bit of a play away from the face guy who might be out there negotiating the contracts to start with. But that's still, though, it's a great way to play it. And because it also switches up the flavor of your game from session to session.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily do it. Like, the GM doesn't have to, like, have one character say, and here's the contracts you can pick from, you know? There could be, like, sessions. Maybe, I mean, you'd have to have something for the other players to do. But there could be sessions where the face guy says, okay, it's time to go out and look for contracts. And you can, like, role play those out. And,
right.
You know,
but if you actually want to make it good, though, there has to be a chance of failure in there. So, you know, if everybody says, all right, I want to do this espionage mission. All right, I'll go get a contract. Oh, sorry, I couldn't get the contract.
Oh, I suppose.
Yeah. Absolutely. But, I mean, you can fail by just not getting the price that you wanted.
Mm.
I mean, there's different ways of failure. But, yeah, no, absolutely right, Chris. I mean, there could be a really really exciting game in the failure. And we touched on it a little bit, but, like, ways around it and extorting. In other ways, you can, like, kill the mercenary company that got the contract or sabotaged them.
There's your reputation.
Yeah. And maybe that's the reputation is other mercenary companies don't want to bid against you.
Because you'll kill them.
Well, that ends our latest installment of Warriors. And thanks again to Jimbo Hawkins for... Hey, John Hawkwood, Jimbo Hawkins.
Possible relation?
Yeah. No. Sorry, Hawkwood, Hawkins. But thank you very much for that recommendation. We really appreciate that. If anybody else would like us to talk about something?
Perhaps in a smoother fashion?
More than one. What more? Oh, talk about Aziz from True Blood a little bit more.
Who said that in? Yeah. Lyle. You don't need to name. You don't need to name. Somebody, one of the listeners. You.
I listened to our episode. All right. But no, we really appreciate it. It was something that we hadn't thought of. And then when we looked into it, we thought, yeah, that's fantastic. Mm. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or through Stitcher, iTunes, or download it from DriveThruRPG. You can post right there on the website or join up in our forums, tell us there, post on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or just send us an email because we love from hearing from all of you. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.